Thank you, Mary, for that prelude, and thank you to Bob Park for sharing this piece that was composed by his son, Robin. Good morning, and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I'm Robin Proud, a member here and a somewhat regular speaker. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter your age or your abilities or inabilities. And we will have a time a little later to invite visitors and guests to introduce yourselves. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of programs. They might be presented by a Prairie member, by a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Reverend Sandy. The opening words are attributed to Edmund Burke, but there's some controversy about it. Many varieties of this have been seen. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing. Our chalice lighting is listed here. We gather this hour as people of faith with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We like to speak of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning in celebration of the life we share together. From Christine Robinson. Well, I used to speak here every year or a couple of years, but because I now have the honor to be one of the rotating speakers at the Sauk County Free Congregation, I've had to come up with more programs, but once I have the programs, you get the benefits of them. And we thought this one might be fitting here around 4th of July. Ever since November, Americans have been fascinated by political dystopias. I overheard Ken as he came in saying that he's been in this reading vein. So you can choose the version of your preference. Do you think the most appropriate one is 1984 with ever-present surveillance and truth being malleable depending on what the government says it is? Or maybe we resemble more Brave New World where citizens are distracted by entertainment and feel-good drugs, so they don't notice that they're being dominated. Then there's The Handmaid's Tale, where the subjugation of women is one sign of this theocratic society. In an essay talking about this not long after the election, I heard this book mentioned, which I did not know about. It has a lot of resonance for us, and so I noticed it had been reissued by Barnes & Noble. And I was surprised to find that it features a Unitarian and a Universalist. This book is It Can't Happen Here, written by Minnesotan Sinclair Lewis in 1935. Lewis had written several best-selling books in the 1920s, including Main Street, Babbitt, and Elmer Gantry. These books satirized the smug materialism of the new middle class in small-town America. But the concerns of the country changed with the stock market crash and the rise of dictators in Europe. So there's something here from the introduction to this edition. In September of 1934, a magazine called The Modern Monthly included a symposium titled Will Fascism Come to America? And it featured a number of leading intellectuals debating that question. In early 1935, a magazine that some of you know, The Nation, ran a series of articles on forerunners of American fascism. But there were other views. William Randolph Hearst, the model for Citizen Kane, who was a very conservative media mogul like some we have today, he stated, "Whenever you hear a prominent American called a fascist, you can usually make up your mind that that man is simply a loyal citizen who stands for Americanism." So this was the same, this came out at the same time that this book was written, is around when that was published. Well, Sinclair Lewis had a unique viewpoint because his wife, Dorothy Thompson, was a journalist. She had interviewed Hitler in the early 1930s, and she had written some articles warning Americans about the danger of his rise. Lewis did not coin the phrase, "It can't happen here," which was already in common usage, but his book with that title became an instant success. He incorporated into it dozens of real figures from the time in the fields of religion, politics, and journalism. So he name drops all these real people of the time. Today I'll tell you a bit about the book, and then what I think are some characteristics of American political and social life today that could empower anti-democratic leaders, as well as some hopeful qualities that could protect us from them. And I'll say something about how UUs could play a role in supporting a robust and free democracy. The hero of the story, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, if it's Doremus or Doremus Jessup, D-O-R-E-M-U-S. He is a mild-mannered newspaper editor, about 60 years old, in a small town in Vermont. And he's the son of a Universalist minister. So we first meet him at the beginning of the book, along with many fellow citizens at a Rotary Club dinner. And this first part of the book is very satirical and humorous. After the main speaker, a retired general, exhorts his listeners with an appeal to both isolationism and militarism at the same time. We should stay out of other countries' affairs, but we should have the best military in the world. He's followed by Mrs. Adelaide Gimmich of the DAR. Doremus thinks the DAR is composed of females who spend one half their waking hours boasting of being descended from the seditious American colonists of 1776, and the other and more ardent half in attacking all contemporaries who believe in precisely the principles for which those ancestors struggled. Mrs. Gimmich insists women's place is in the home and every woman ought to have 6 children. We see a response to this from one Lorinda Pike, widow of a notorious Unitarian preacher. She was the village scold, the village crank. She was constantly poking into things that were none of her business. And at town meetings, she criticized every substantial interest in the country. The electric company's rates, the salaries of the school teachers, the ministerial association's high-minded censorship of books for the public library. So to Mrs. Gimmich's advice that women should have 6 children, Lorinda responds, "But what if a poor girl can't hook a man? Have her 6 kids out of wedlock?" Doremus, described as a littleish man, soothes over the disagreement, and then they move on to the singing of patriotic songs by one of their neighbors, Louis Rotenstern. Although Louis's grandfather had come from a Prussian ghetto, Louis was, quote, "not only 100% American, he He exacted 40% chauvinistic interest on top of that principal. He was on every occasion heard to say, "We ought to keep all these foreigners out of the country." And what I mean, the kikes just as much as the wops and hunkies and chinks. This is a small town life. That evening, Doremus attends another event, a social dinner with leaders of the town. Some of them are the quarry owner, the banker, the school superintendent, and the Episcopal minister. The talk turns to the current election. Senator Berzelius, known as Buzz Windrip, is a leading candidate. And they talked about the influence of religious figures, a bishop who has a great following on the radio. If Bishop Prang, our Savonarola in a Cadillac 16, swings his radio audience and his League of Forgotten Men to Buzz Windrip, Buzz will win. People will think they're electing him to create more economic security. Then watch, a real fascist dictatorship. "Nonsense," snorted Tasbro, the quarry owner. "That couldn't happen here in America. Not possibly. We're a country of free men." "The answer to that," suggests Doremus Jessup, "is the hell it can't. Why, there's no country in the world that can get more hysterical, yes, or more obsequious than America. Look at how Huey Long became absolute monarch over Louisiana." Of course, that is a historical figure. "Remember our war hysteria when we called sauerkraut liberty cabbage?" I didn't know about that one, but Freedom Fries wasn't the first menu change. "Remember our Red Scares and our Catholic Scares. When Al Smith was running in the 1920s, apparently Protestants were warned that their children's baptisms would no longer be good. So this was like Sharia law, right? Some other religion would take over. Yes, remember our Red Scares and our Catholic Scares? Remember how trainloads of people have gone to enjoy lynchings? Why, where in all history has there ever been a people so ripe for a dictatorship as ours?" But the only response that Jessup can make in his paper is to, he says, "write another editorial viewing with alarm." Right? This paper views with alarm the tendency to. Well, Buzz Windrip is helped in his campaign by religious radio personalities and by his militia, which becomes basically a private army. He claims he will save the forgotten man. He promises they'll receive several thousand dollars apiece, which was a fortune at this time of the Depression. He puts out a ghostwritten autobiography. He glorifies himself and attacks his enemies, including the press. He says he can save Americans from international threats, which at that time he identified as communism, atheism, and the international Jewish finance cabal. In this version of history, Buzz Windrip is actually running for the Democratic nomination against Franklin Roosevelt and Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins. So we have a woman running for president in this scenario. But, the book says, every delegate knew that Mr. Roosevelt and Miss Perkins were far too lacking in circus tinsel and general clownishness to succeed at this critical hour of the nation's hysteria, when the electorate wanted a ringmaster revolutionist like Senator Windrip. The circus metaphor has been used recently. And he takes out a catchy phrase about cleaning up the Capitol. This is, he's going to wash, capital W-A-S-H, period, and to wash in small letters. So a phrase about cleaning up features. He puts out a 15-point victory program, which gives him control of banks, labor unions, and the treasury. He promises absolute freedom of religious worship, provided, however, that no atheist, agnostic, believer in black magic, nor any Jew who shall refuse to swear allegiance to the New Testament, nor any person of any faith who refuses to take the pledge to the flag, shall be permitted to hold any office or practice as a teacher, professor, lawyer, judge, or physician. Also, all Negroes, as they're termed, shall be prohibited from voting, holding professional jobs, or earning over a certain salary. Women are to, quote, return to their incomparably sacred duties as homemakers and mothers. These plans seem to encompass both traditional right and left ideas, such as government control of industry and also building up defense to surpass every other country in the world. So Dora Miss Jessup tries to understand Winthrop's extraordinary appeal. He says, the senator was vulgar, almost illiterate, a public liar easily detected, and in his ideas almost idiotic, while his celebrated piety was that of a traveling salesman for church furniture. But he was an actor of genius and had uncommon natural ability to be authentically excited by his and with his audience, and they by and with him. He's assisted by the media, which at that time were newspaper men and radio. By the unusual spiritedness and color of their attacks on him, they kept his name alive in every column. In the end, who votes for him and ends up electing him? This book tells us the unemployed, the underpaid, the mortgaged, the American Legion, the supporters of radio preachers, the remnants of the Ku Klux Klan, lawyers who think they may get a job in the new administration, and a good number of businessmen and bankers. They trust that his common man rhetoric is only a campaign ploy and that he will come through for them after the election. And of the common men who voted for him, most of them had noticed only three planks in Winthrop's platform: increasing taxes on the rich, the expected payment of several thousand, and the one which condemned the Negroes, since nothing so elevates a dispossessed farmer or a factory worker on relief as to have some race, any race, on which he can look down. Winthrop has an unexciting general election opponent who, quote, conducted his campaign as placidly as though he were certain to win. In the wake of this election, Jessup tries to continue his editorial job, but it was maddening that it seemed impossible now to know anything surely. He's wary of radical responses, knowing that revolution and idealism have often led themselves to war and despotism. But his moderate views are soon challenged in a series of moves. Buzz and his militia supplant Congress and the courts and imprison any journalists who oppose them. Colleges, those bastions of communism and anarchy, are shut down. And I was happy to see a shout out to my alma mater of Carleton mentioned in there with some Ivy League schools, but Sinclair Lewis was from Minnesota. The bonuses promised to citizens never appear. Instead, people are put into work camps and sent to work for private companies at the lowest possible wages. That seems like something we could envision. Jessup for a while is allowed to stay on as editor, but all his writings must be approved by a local authority. At this point, Jessup has an epiphany. The tyranny of this dictatorship isn't primarily the fault of big business, nor of the demagogues who do their dirty work. It's the fault of Dora Miss Jessup, of all the conscientious, respectable, lazy-minded Dora Miss Jessups who have let the demagogues wriggle in without fierce enough protest. And there are scenes early in the book where he and his family are having a picnic and people are going about their business, thinking that nothing really bad can happen here. At this point, he becomes more desperate. He tries various maneuvers. He works with some of his neighbors to put out underground news. He tries to escape with his family to Canada, but he's turned back by the militia. With great difficulty, he makes contact with the communist underground, but he finds that they want him to swear unwavering loyalty to their cause no matter what, and he refuses to do that. Eventually, he and his neighbors end up in prisons or camps, having been snitched on by other neighbors. They're encouraged then to betray each other, and there are some horrible scenes in the camps. A secret resistance still exists, and Lorinda, the troublemaking Unitarian, eventually is able to help Jessup escape. He becomes kind of another Tom Joad, a man of the people. The book ends, and still Doremus goes on in the red sunrise, for a Doremus Jessup can never die. Now, this book isn't the best put together. It was written really quickly. But, meanwhile, in the book, the revolution goes the way of all revolutions and begins to devour its own. Those who condemn Jessup end up being betrayed in their turn and going to the camps, and eventually even Winthrop is overthrown. This novel was an instant success, and the movie rights were optioned, and I'll read something about that. because you may not remember ever seeing a movie. There's a good reason. Long before it became a bestseller, Hollywood had taken notice. Lewis sold movie rights to MGM while the novel was still in manuscript. They commissioned a script, and they cast the venerable Lionel Barrymore, who had already won an Academy Award, as Doremus. They built the sets, and then canceled the film in mid-February 1936. Exactly what happened depends on who tells the story. Lewis insisted that the Production Code Administration, popularly known as the Hays Office, known for its censoring of films, he said, in a fantastic exhibition of folly and cowardice, had effectively banned the film for fear of international complications. That is, the office had interfered to avoid offending the German and Italian governments. But while not adapted to the screen in 1936, the novel was adapted to the stage in 1937 under the auspices of the Federal Theater Project, a part of the Works Progress Administration, WPA. Lewis collaborated on the script. The play was a smash hit. 21 different productions opened simultaneously in 18 different cities on October 27, 1937. One of them was a Yiddish production in New York. There was a Spanish production in Tampa and an all-African-American production in Seattle. The play seemed to have practically unlimited audience appeal. As recently as 2011, the play was performed at 20 theaters across the U.S. to mark the 75th anniversary of its premiere. So, what elements of this story exist today that could favor a similar dystopian turn? Well, I'll briefly mention three. The first is the American worship of the great man. And it's always a man. It's not a woman. People want to believe in the promise of someone that says he is the one who can fix everything. People want the president to be a sort of dictator. I've always thought it was odd that there's so much focus on a president's personal views of, say, gun rights or abortion rights, as if he is going to make rules himself based solely on that view. Recent photo ops of a president signing a piece of paper play into this idea. Oh, that's it. He signed a paper. It's done. Now, to be fair, this president didn't originate this type of signing. But I would say that most people around the country, if you asked them, would say, oh, yes, he signed this paper about immigration or the environment, and that's it, having no conception of how laws actually get made. And I think sometimes presidents are frustrated to find out how much harder it is than they thought. Well, it works both ways, right? Obama was going to close Guantanamo first thing. So the flip side of the worship of the individual, our second item, is a distrust of institutions and organizations. These could be governmental, Congress, the courts, the Treasury Department. They could be social, the media, mainline churches, universities, public schools. And even on the personal level, a distrust of science, a cherry picking of facts. And that can also be bipartisan. It tends to be people on the left who are very excited about vaccines regardless of scientific information. So the third element is demonization of the other side. I was going to refer to some recent articles, but there were too many. Polls show that many people now would not want their child to marry someone of the other party. They'd rather they marry a different race, religion, but not the other party. And we've seen this where compromise is equivalent to selling out. And this has been the last four presidents, at least, who have been really demonized by their opponents. So it's not new that a president is accused of things. It's just that some of the ones we had before did not shout back at everything that was said about them. Social media, which of course didn't exist at the time of Lewis's book, aggravates these tendencies. It allows us to stay within side like-minded bubbles, and also makes it easy that if someone does post something they believe in or state something, they can be viciously and anonymously attacked by the other side. And we've already seen disturbed individuals from both sides take violent action in response to views they cultivated online. You may have seen other elements in this novel that match our lives today. So what do we do about it, and how are we as you used to respond? under a Buzz Windrip administration you use would be highly suspect. Our principles include several dangerous ideas. First principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. So no separate categories by race, for instance, or by religion. Fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregation and in society at large. And sixth principle, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. And I think that many political figures today probably would find that very disturbing, including some from Wisconsin. I don't know of many denominations that mention democracy and world community in their beliefs, although my husband pointed out that the Baha'is do this. So we are called by our religion to speak up against threats to freedom, whether here or abroad. And of course, this is why many UUs have figured in all sorts of movements, from civil rights, gay rights, environmental issues, and so on. What are some elements of modern society, on the other hand, that would help us fight for our beliefs? Sometimes they're the same as those that threaten us. Modern technology can encourage hate speech, but it can also allow activists to find each other. And there are a number of groundswell groups that have formed under different names around the country and are able to be in touch and mobilize in the current time. A story that goes viral, sometimes that could be very hateful, but it could also be helpful. When the late night host Jimmy Kimmel talked about his baby being born with a life-threatening illness and how he saw that could affect others as well and how healthcare had an immediate impact, that becomes real for people. Another instance of technology, citizens with cell phones have begun to focus attention on police brutality, even if convictions of police are still rare. Of course, it's not that these incidents have just started happening, but there was no way to document them. So in some ways, technology can help us. Another factor that is important to us is that First Amendment rights are key in the United States. In Europe, it is illegal to deny that the Holocaust happened. Understandably, we might wish to silence this claim and other horrific claims like Sandy Hook was a hoax or 9/11 was an inside job. But I think the best protection for all of us is to allow even hateful speech and make sure it's answered powerfully. Our aggressive support of free speech in America can be aggravating when we have horrible examples like Alex Jones, but it's a great protection against the secret suppression of rights. Our institutions, while perhaps weakened, are still resilient. In his book, Sinclair Lewis glosses quickly over how easily Windrip takes over all the branches of government and silences dissent. I don't think it would be quite that easy. But he wasn't necessarily wrong that this could happen. In a way, Hitler accomplished this in Germany. You don't necessarily need to suspend government. You just need to be sure it agrees with you. Or perhaps just ensure that government officials are more concerned about getting reelected and pleasing their donors than about making tough decisions on behalf of their constituents. So this is where I'm supposed to tell you about what you should do to support our UU heritage and beliefs. But I think Sandy is going to do that in a few weeks. However, yes, this is a time when many of our tenets are under attack: compassion, reason, and internationalism, for instance. So I'm actually going to ask you about this. I know many of you are involved in many different ways, whether it's environment, education, voting rights, police brutality, community building. So I'll turn this over to you for suggestions or any comments. Well, humor is always a good way to counter self-important people. I noticed on our list, our famous Unitarians out there, that Thomas Nast is featured. He was a cartoonist who got rid of Boss Tweed in New York. So I'm going to be talking about him later this year sometime, and something about political satire, which is also having a good year. And I was going to mention there's a definite stress element among people who have family members who are undocumented, for instance, or people who have health conditions or have family members with disability. And then, of course, one headline said, if you plan to get old, you'll need Medicaid. So maybe more of us should be concerned then.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. And as I said, I have a feeling that what Sandy's going to talk about in a few weeks may be a good follow-up for this. So that's great. I was just going to mention that, of course, as a nonprofit religious institution, we do not take stands for or against certain candidates or parties. In this book, it's the Democratic Party, which is taken over by this figure. But it's certainly, we certainly do take stands about issues, which there are many to discuss. As Barb reminded us, singing could be a good response. It has been in many countries around the world to challenging times. Our closing words, be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, the truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living. From Theodore Parker. So please greet your neighbor, and there's coffee and there are some treats from the bakery.